Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. You guys, we are at episode 100. We hit 100 episodes, and it's all because of you guys, my Residue crew, my Residudes. I am so stoked to have you all in my community. This is amazing. I have the greatest listeners ever in the entire podcast community, and I want to thank you for this, because I wouldn't have made it to 100 episodes if it wasn't for all of you. My paranoia people, you guys know that Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne. And the best thing that you can possibly do if you want to help out the podcast is leave a 5-star review or share the episodes with your friends. Tell everyone you know about Residue. And we just have to say it for anyone that is new here. We have switched up our format at Residue. We now will be telling you all of the true stories, the true crimes behind your favorite movies. And do not forget to follow me on all the socials. We have Instagram, Residue Podcast, TikTok, Residue A True Crime Pod, Facebook, Residue A True Crime Podcast. And you can DM me, you can email me. Let me know if you have any suggestions for some made-for-television films, for some movies that you want to really know the true crime behind. I have gotten so many amazing suggestions. You guys rule. You know what? Since we're at episode 100, maybe we should pull out a little Jefferson Starship. So if you love the show, if you're loving what I'm laying down here, don't forget to hit that follow button. And I'm gonna sing some songs for you to remind you to go hit that follow button. So we can build this dream together, stand in stone forever. Nothing's gonna stop us now. No. That was the worst, but you know, I never do two takes. I'm a one-take Johnny. We're going to keep it running. We're going to go with that one. And please hit that follow button. Today, we are talking about probably the movie that made us all a little paranoid, that kind of changed all of our lives, the movie that traumatized all of Generation X. This is the movie Adam. And today, we will be talking about the case of Adam Walsh. And as always, listener discretion is advised. Even strong men will weep after watching Adam. It's one of the most moving made-for-TV movies, or for that matter, movies that I've seen in a long while. If you've ever had a child or been one, don't miss it. That was a quote from Peter Bunzel of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner on October 9th, 1983. He said this of the made-for-television film, Adam. Adam aired on NBC in 1983. It aired October 10th, 1983, and that was the original air date, but Adam was actually rebroadcast a couple of times, once on April 30th, 1984, and then again on April 29th, 1985. On the first night that it aired, 38 million people saw this movie. It told the real devastating story of 6-year-old Adam Walsh. The made-for-television film portrayed the story of the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh on July 27th, 1981. A simple trip to the Sears department store becomes every parent's worst nightmare. The 1983 film was based on the true story of Adam Walsh, who was abducted from a Florida shopping mall in 1981 and later found murdered. And this film follows his parents, John and Revae Walsh, as they struggle with grief, a flawed investigation, and their fight to change how missing children cases are handled in the U.S. And the movie starred Daniel J. Travanti and Jo Beth Williams. And Adam raised national awareness and helped lead to major reforms in child protection laws. And we're going to go a lot deeper into the story in the next segment. But I wanted to let you know that at the end of every single broadcast of Adam, they aired pictures of missing children. As the credits begin to roll, the screen fades to black, and then photos of real missing children appear on screen. And this is what made Adam different. At the end of the movie, they aired 55 missing children, and they asked viewers to call in with tips, and 13 of those children were found because of this movie. Daniel J. Travanti was fresh off of Hill Street Blues, and he said this role was the most emotional of his career. So Adam wasn't just a movie. It was this turning point in America that forced law enforcement to act. And it turned one family's tragedy into this nationwide movement. It is the early 80s. So what was happening at the time? We had Luke and Laura from General Hospital, and they were about to get married. But everyone was also excited for another marriage that was about to take place, and that was Prince Charles and Diana Spencer. And the biggest thought on people's mind when it came to true crime was, who shot JR? So from the show Dallas, this was like the most true crime that people got at this time. This is the most that they would consume. And the biggest question on everyone's mind was, who shot JR? Because more viewers than any TV show in history at this time, it was 80 million viewers, watched the finale of Dallas where JR gets shot. I know all of my fellow Gen Xers remember these things very vividly from our childhood. And then we saw the movie Adam. And that is what most likely got a lot of you interested in true crime, or most likely got a lot of us to become these very paranoid, stay paranoid type of people that were always looking over our shoulder, watching out for anything bad that could come our way. Adam's story, the Walsh's story, it became a cautionary tale for parents everywhere. I was 7 years old when I watched the movie Adam. I couldn't wrap my head around it. I didn't believe this was real. Hearing that this is a true story, I couldn't believe there were monsters like this out in the world. It doesn't seem real to me. It was so horrifying, so scary. It was the scariest thing I had ever seen. On November 14th, 1974, John Walsh was sitting in the waiting room of a hospital, and a nurse walked up to him and said, "It's a boy." And he describes that day as a blur of happiness. He said, "We named him Adam after my father." In his book, Tears of Rage, John Walsh describes this day. "The day that Adam was born was like no other day of my life. We were happy beyond words. I remember calling everybody up and screaming and yelling. I was delirious, elated beyond measure. As of that day, my life was perfect. Reve and I were fine. Work was going great, and now we had a little boy, a little baby boy." Adam is described as a quiet, shy little kid, and John even said, all in all, he was a mature, grown-up little guy, but in a lot of ways, he was also a typical little boy. He loved to do little kid things. John also says that Adam was always dressed like to the nines. He looked like a little like businessman on the playground compared to all of the other little kids. He was a sharp-dressed, sharp-looking little kid. And that is why this dapper little guy chose to wear his beige-colored captain's hat on July 27th, 1981, when he accompanied his mother to Sears. Now, Reve was at home, and John called her from work. He's like, "Honey, listen, the lamp that we've wanted for a long time, it's on sale at Sears today only. You got to get down there and grab that lamp." And she was like, "Okay, sure." So Adam puts on some green shorts. He's got this red and white polo shirt on, some sandals with a yellow bottom and straps. And Adam and Reve go to Sears. When they arrive, they walk in the front door, and Adam sees that a group of kids are standing in the toy section, and they have an Atari set up, and they're playing Asteroids, I believe. And Adam was like, "Oh my God, Mom, please, I want to play with the kids." He's 6 years old, and we have to remember, it was the 80s. It was the very early 80s. And Reve said, "Okay, honey, listen, I'm going to go to the lamp section." Adam says he knows where that is. She said, "I don't want you to leave from this section. I'm going to be right back." And she's only gone about 5 or 10 minutes, maybe even less, actually. She comes back to the video game section, and Adam is nowhere to be found. And she's like, "Okay, let's look around a little bit more." She goes back to the lamp section. She's starting to get a little frantic. Adam is nowhere. She spends a little time searching the aisles, and she can't find her son. Reve goes up to an employee and she said, "Did you see my son? He was standing here playing the video game." And the employee says, "No, I'm sorry." But they end up paging Adam, and Adam doesn't show up. While she's looking and waiting for Adam to respond to this page, she notices that Adam's grandmother, John's mother, is actually also at Sears. So the two of them join forces. They're both frantic, and they're both searching everywhere for Adam. And 2 hours goes by. There is still no sign of Adam anywhere. And this is when Reve reports her 6-year-old son missing. So police arrive, and Reve finds out that a fight broke out between these kids that were at this video game. Adam didn't know any of these children. And the fight breaks out. Security is sent over. But when I say security, I mean a 17-year-old girl who was working a part-time job as a security officer at this Sears. Now, she tells these kids that they have to leave. She's like, "I'm not standing for any of this. Everyone leave." Even this little 6-year-old. She pushes them out the door, but she pushes them out a back entrance. And this entrance, Adam would not be familiar with. He did not come in this entrance. He doesn't know where he's going. So she pushes him out, and he is outside now all alone. He's 6 years old. I know it's the 80s, so I have to keep that in mind, take that into account. This is why I don't let my son out of my sight. But we didn't know. We didn't know better back then. And this young girl didn't know any better. I mean, she's 17 years old, so we can't really blame her. But, you know, we can kind of blame Sears, maybe, for not giving a 17-year-old proper training. I don't know if it's protocol to kick 6-year-olds out of the store and push them back into a back alley of a mall, but I don't know. Now, John and Reve say that Adam was a really shy kid, and there's no way he would have spoken up and said, "But my mom is over in the light section." He would have listened to an authority figure, and he would have done what she said. Hours and hours of searching this mall, this parking lot, there's no sign of Adam. There's nothing. Police have nothing. And Reve is so just distraught. She leaves her car in the parking lot, hoping that if Adam is just wandering around, maybe he will find her car. Maybe he'll come back to the car. Can you just stop and think for a moment how that would have felt to have to leave that mall, leave that Sears without your son? I don't know how they did it. But here's the thing is that John Walsh was a luxury hotel manager. He was in the luxury hotel business and the marketing business and selling sales. He had a lot of knowledge about marketing. And the first thing that he thought to do was go straight to the media. So the Walshes used the media to their advantage. And you have to remember, there's no social media. There's no Facebook, no Instagram. There's no way to get this message out there quicker than getting on the news, than handing out flyers. When John and Reve sat on those news channels pleading for Adam to come home, they actually gave him directions on how to find his way home, just in case. Here I go crying again. Okay. Just in case he was watching and he couldn't figure out how to get home. Almost right away, there is tension between the Walshes and the police. The police were not equipped or had any knowledge on how to deal with this situation. This was something completely out of the Hollywood Police Department's league. And the FBI was brought in, but the FBI was brought in a little too late. They should have been brought in a lot quicker. There were a lot of things that should have been, could have been done very differently in this case. And a lot of the eyewitness testimonies didn't come in until much later. Like a lot of the witnesses, they waited to say anything for different reasons. They all had their own reasons as to why they waited. I mean, one of the witnesses waited until around 1991, like 10 years later, to come forward and say that he thought he saw a man put a kid into a car, and that car was a Cadillac. One of the tips came in about 4 days after Adam went missing, and this woman was named Marilyn. So Marilyn calls police to say that her son, Timmy, might have seen something that was important. And he says that he saw a child being pulled into a dark blue van in the Sears parking lot. So all they have right now to go on is a dark blue van. And this woman, Marilyn, she wouldn't let the police talk to her child one-on-one because she said he suffered from migraines and she didn't know, his doctor didn't say if it would be okay or not for police to talk to him. So basically they have Marilyn's word that her son saw a dark blue van take a little kid. So they're now on to every single a dark blue van that they can find in Florida, in Hollywood, Florida. And that's a lot of dark blue vans. Now, Detective Joe Matthews gets involved in this case. He is a polygraph expert, and Detective Jack Hoffman was the lead detective on the Adam Walsh case. So, Detective Joe Matthews, he wants to give a polygraph test to, obviously, everyone in the family. And during John Walsh's polygraph, where John Walsh was ruled out right away, the information comes up during this polygraph that John's friend, Jimmy Campbell, he was actually an employee at the hotel that John worked at. He was a pool boy. Jimmy Campbell lived with the Walshes, I believe it was up until the day before Adam went missing. So this seemed very suspicious. Detectives soon learn that Jimmy Campbell was living with the Walshes and John wasn't home a lot. John was a businessman. He was always away on trips. And Jimmy was almost like a big brother to Adam. And they had a very close, very tight-knit relationship. But Jimmy was also having an affair with Reve, and he started feeling guilty about this, and he left. He left the home because he couldn't do this to his friend John anymore. Jimmy takes a polygraph test, and it is proven that he is not being deceptive, but Detective Hoffman was so adamant that Jimmy was the guy. He just thought this whole affair with Reve and the attachment to Adam, this was definitely their guy in Detective Hoffman's mind. And this whole idea that Jimmy was the killer, it really just wrecked a lot of the investigating that they could have been doing because Detective Hoffman wouldn't listen to other people. He wouldn't even listen to Joe Matthews, the polygraph expert, who kept telling him, listen, I think this guy's being honest. He's not deceptive at all. It doesn't matter. Hoffman's going to hold on to this idea that Jimmy Campbell's our guy. So, August 10th, 1981, the Walshes, John and Reve, are in New York City because they're going to be on Good Morning America. They're going to be offering a reward for info on Adam. And right before their Good Morning America appearance, they get a phone call from detectives. So this is 2 weeks after Adam has been missing. They found Adam's head. Two fishermen are walking along the highway, walking along banks along the highway in Indian River County, and they're trying to find some fishing spots. And they notice something floating in the water, and as they get closer, they realize that they are looking at a human head. And they call police, and police immediately inform John and Reve, and they tell them they're going to need an identification. They're going to need somebody to identify if this is Adam or not. And I don't know how you even hear those words. And they get one of their very close friends to do this for them. Thank God for this close friend. So they also say they're going to need some dental records. And the friend goes and identifies the remains. And the dental records come back that this is, in fact, Adam Walsh. Now, while this is happening, Jimmy is still in with the polygraph expert. Jimmy is still being interrogated by Detective Hoffman, and they want him to take a second polygraph. And they go in to the polygraph room and they tell him, you know what? They found a head and we need a confession. And they're giving Jimmy this second polygraph test. And the detective, Joe Matthews, is saying, listen, I'm not going to coerce a confession out of this guy. I've given him this second polygraph test and he's passing it. He is not deceptive. Also, he just heard some horrific news. I mean, what if this guy isn't guilty? You have him in an interrogation room where he just found out that a little boy that he's been living with, his best friend's kid, has been kidnapped, murdered, and they just found his decapitated head. And now you are pressuring him to tell you that he's the one that did it. And so here's the deal. The whole entire nation is talking about this crime. It is all over the place. We got the Walshes about to go on Good Morning America and they find their child's head in a river. Everyone needs this man caught, this person caught who did this. And Detective Hoffman knows he needs to have someone in cuffs and he needs to have someone in cuffs pretty fucking soon. So his best option is Jimmy. Jimmy, literally, there's no evidence pointing towards Jimmy at all. He's passed two polygraphs, and I know we can't always take a polygraph test, you know, into consideration because they're not always right. But still, there's no other evidence saying that Jimmy's the guy that did it. The autopsy reveals that there were at least 5 to 6 blows to the back of Adam's head. They also think that he was face down when his head was severed from his body, and they do believe that this happened post-mortem and that the cause of death was asphyxiation. So they have a funeral for Adam, and I'm talking within days of this funeral, these two, Reve and John, these two badasses, they immediately form the Adam Walsh Outreach Center for Missing Children in their garage. And they said, you know what? We need this place. We need organization to start. We don't have any organization in this police department. You know what? I'm going to find my kid's killer. How about that? And more importantly, they're already thinking about other parents that are going to go through this. Other people are going to go through this, and there is no organization. So procedures, they need to be in order, and they need to be in order now. Let's fix this. The movie Adam aired on October 10th, 1983, and the very next day, the Hollywood Police Department gets a call from a detective named Steve Kendrick. He informs Hollywood Police that he is now interviewing a man named Otis Toole. And this man, Otis, claims that he killed Adam Walsh. And at this time, Otis was already in jail. He was in prison for arson. So this confession is now 2 years after the murder of Adam Walsh. He was not in prison during July of 1981. So who is Otis Toole? He was born in March of 1947. He never knew his father, but he had a stepfather, but he never bonded with him. Now, Otis had an IQ of 75, and that's just above the average intellect of a 12-year-old. His mother was named Sarah, and as a child, Otis was bullied quite a bit. And one day, one of the kids in the neighborhood threw a rock right at his head, hit him right in the skull, and ever since that day, Otis suffered seizures. He also claimed that he was sexually molested as a child when he was 6 years old. He also believed that he was gay, but he wasn't quite sure. He thought he might have been bi. He did actually end up marrying a woman at one point. He said that his one source of comfort was his mom, Sarah. Now, Otis was the youngest of 9 children. While he's in prison for arson, let me give you a list of some other things that he's been arrested for. Vagrancy, prowling, loitering, lewd and lascivious behavior, public intoxication, cross-dressing in public, window peeping, exposing himself in public. Otis's mother, Sarah, died on May 16th, 1981, and Tool was 34 years old at this time in 1981. He also said to police that he heard voices telling him to kill himself after his mother's death so that he could be with his mother. So Otis had a lover named Henry Lee Lucas, who you might know because Henry Lee Lucas is loosely depicted in the movie Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. I mean, I can have a whole podcast episode just about Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Tool, these two fuckbags here. So these two, let's get into Otis's confession. Otis Tool says that he and Henry Lee Lucas were, in fact, in Florida in 1981. They were driving around together. One day, they decided to take a boy. And he describes the boy that they took, but it isn't the same description as Adam. He is around 6 years old, but just the hair doesn't match. Like, his description isn't exactly Adam Walsh. But he says that he and Henry took a little boy. They kidnapped him. They put him in the back seat. Henry sat in the back seat with the boy, and Otis drove. So Henry's in the back seat with this boy, and the boy is fighting back. And Otis claims that this is when Henry decapitated the little boy. He says that he never saw the movie Adam, so he didn't know anything about this case. And at the time of Adam's abduction, Henry Lee Lucas was incarcerated. So they're like, okay, Otis, you're telling us that you and your lover, Henry, drove around, picked up a boy, the boy was fighting back, and Henry decapitated him. But you know what? Henry was in jail. He was in prison at this time. So you're going to have to tell us the truth now. So right away, detectives are not sure that they can trust him because Otis Tool and Henry Lee Lucas were known for confessing to thousands of murders. They were actually called the confession killers. They just loved to say, I did it. So they catch him in a lie because Henry was in jail. Otis changes his story again. And this time he says that he himself actually went to the Sears, went to the mall. He lured Adam into his car using candy. Adam got into the car on his own. Otis didn't have to like force him in or anything. He says that immediately as they're driving away, he's thinking to himself, you know what? I want to raise this boy as my own. And I'm thinking, you know, he just lost his mother. He must be longing for family. And he's thinking the way to do it is to kidnap a little boy. So he says, I'm going to raise this kid. It's going to be me and him for the rest of our lives. And that is until Adam starts acting up. Because, of course, Adam is a smart kid. And Otis knew this. He said, this kid is too smart. He knows my face. He knows what I'm doing. He's going to tell on me. He's not going to just live with me and let me be his new dad. So he decided that he's going to have to get rid of him. Now they're driving, and Adam, he says, Otis says this, that Adam is acting up. He's yelling, he's screaming, and he's telling Adam to shut up. This is when he starts hitting him. He's just punching this six-year-old boy in the face, in the head, telling him to shut the hell up. He says that he pulls the car over, and he takes Adam out of the car And this is when he decapitated him. He said that he hit him about 5 to 6 times on the back of the head before his head was severed from his body. Okay. And he says that he didn't plan this. This wasn't something that he planned. He actually wanted to take Adam home and raise him. And that the reason that he lied about Henry being involved was because he was trying to get back at Henry Lewis, and that was going to be his revenge to frame him for the murder of Adam Walsh, even though he did it himself. So police want to take Otis's car, and they want to go through the entire thing. They want to get some evidence, but the car was sold to a car lot. It's a lot of back and forth with where this car went, and the police finally locate the car that Adam was in, allegedly, according to Otis, and they find blood present on the driver's side. And it was only 1983. So you have to remember that DNA testing wasn't what it is now. So they transport Otis Toole from the prison he's in another area of Florida, to Hollywood, Florida, to see if he can identify the location that Adam was abducted from. So these police officers actually take Otis Toole to 2 different malls, the Hollywood Mall where Adam did disappear and a different mall, because they want to see if he's telling them the truth. And he does say that the Hollywood Mall where the Sears is, it looks familiar. But then the police drive him around the turnpike and they're, you know, trying to see if he would know where Adam's head was found. And Otis is saying that he can't remember. He can't remember any of this. He can't remember where he left Adam's body. He doesn't really recognize anything. But then he does say he recognizes the spot where he threw the head. But police are a little weary because how can they trust him? Because they know that Otis might have seen crime photos when they were questioning him. They know that Otis might have seen the movie Adam. They can't quite be sure. At this point, Otis is telling them that Adam's buried at his mom's house. It's just, there's so much back and forth with this guy, and I feel like all of the details get so convoluted and it's confusing, and I don't know if I believe that Otis Toole did this or not. So police are trying to prove that Otis was even in Hollywood, Florida around July 27th, 1981, and they can't prove it. There's just not enough evidence. And in November, he changes his story again. He tells the police that he did burn Adam's remains at his mom's house, but then he went to a garbage dump and disposed of everything. All of the clothing, everything. And so neighbors, they go and talk to neighbors, and neighbors do confirm that Otis was at his mom's house a lot, and he was in the yard digging a lot, but they can't prove that he was there specifically on July 27th, 1981, burying or burning Adam's body. Detectives even go back and talk to some of the inmates that were in prison with Otis when they aired the movie Adam, because they were like, okay, did you guys all sit here and watch this movie? And all of them said the same thing, that the movie Adam came on. Yeah, it was on for a few minutes, but they turned the channel and they all watched football that night. Okay, so then they gotta go to Otis's mother's house and search, because he has said, yes, I burned Adam's body at my mother's house. So they go and they search his mother's property. So another slight change in the story. When Otis realizes that he has hit Adam so many times in the car and he's still breathing, he says that he then strangled him to death with a seatbelt, then dragged him out of the car, decapitated him with a machete. Then he says that he took his body to his mother's house in Jacksonville. This is where his mother had this old refrigerator, like ice box in the backyard. And he says that he incinerated the body in this old refrigerator. So let's stop talking about Otis Toole for a second. Another suspect comes into play. And this is one of the most infamous suspects of this case. It's Jeffrey Dahmer. Now, when this happened to Adam Walsh, Jeffrey Dahmer wasn't the Dahmer that we know right now. He wasn't, you know, arrested. He wasn't caught yet for any of his crimes. But they say that Jeffrey Dahmer was in the Hollywood, Florida area at this exact time in 1981. A lot of people discredit this claim because this isn't Dahmer's MO. Some people do say, you know what? Maybe it wasn't his MO then, but he tried to kidnap a child and he didn't like it. So everyone has their theory. A lot of theories going on about who actually kidnapped and killed Adam Walsh. So I found this Curb Archive article written by Stephen Delaney. And in it, it discusses the fact that Jeffrey Dahmer confessed to all of his crimes, but he adamantly denies having anything to do with Adam Walsh. So a lot of people say, like, well, if this guy is going to confess to every single thing, why would he just say no to that one? Author Jay Harris wrote the book Jeffrey Dahmer's Dirty Secret, and he very much so believes that Jeffrey Dahmer kept this secret. He did kill Adam Walsh. He says, when a serial killer is captured and they begin revealing some things about themselves, should we automatically believe that when they say something, that they are no longer telling lies and keeping secrets? So like just because Dahmer said, okay, I'm going to tell you guys everything, does that mean he's really telling us everything? He says that there is every reason to believe that Jeffrey Dahmer did not confess to all of his crimes and he kept some secrets. He thinks trusting the word of a serial killer is illogical, and there is no reason to believe Dahmer had become a truth teller all of a sudden once he was captured. Yeah, I don't know if I buy the Dahmer theory either. I don't know. It just doesn't, I don't feel like it fits. But who am I? You know, I don't know. I'm just telling you the details. So we're going to go back to Addis Toole. So they have searched his mother's home and they do end up finding a couple pieces of clothing. They find these little sandals. So sad. And they do show the evidence to Revee. And she says, no, those are not Adam's. And the sandals actually looked like they would be for a younger child, which gives me chills. I mean, it's scary as shit, right? That they found children's clothing on the property of this man who has confessed to killing a six-year-old. Now, back in 1983, there wasn't much they could do with that blood-stained carpet. So they wanted to retest that carpet and that blood stain in 1994. In 1994, an FBI agent comes forward and he says that he wants to go back, revisit the Adam Walsh case. He wants to take the carpet from the car and the blood sample. He wants to figure this shit out. He goes to the Hollywood Police Department to get this evidence, and guess what? They lost it. They can't find it. That piece of evidence, the carpet from the car with the blood stain on it, you know how huge that would have been? I'll link a picture, or I'll have a picture on my Instagram, on my Facebook, of this stain that was on the carpet. Now, a lot of people say, if you zoom in close, this stain does look like Adam's face. I will let you decide. I feel like I see it, but it's also one of those things where, is that what I want to see? Is that already planted in my brain that that's what I'm going to see when I'm looking at it? Addis Toole was never charged in Adam Walsh's case. And the years just keep going by. And by 2007, this is when people start saying it could be Jeffrey Dahmer. And Dahmer's own father called the America's Most Wanted hotline to say, you know, I think my son could have been involved in Adam's murder. But by 2008, December 16th, 2008, to be exact, the Hollywood police chief, Chad Wagner, along with Revee and John Walsh, they made the announcement that this case is closed. The Adam Walsh case is closed. And they announced that they were satisfied with the suspect being Addis Toole. Thank you. from tragedy to change, the Walshes never stopped trying to change the way that children abduction cases are handled. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was founded in 1984 by John Walsh and Reveille Walsh. This serves as the national clearinghouse for missing children cases, and it has helped recover over 400,000 missing children as of 2025. The national 24-hour toll-free missing children's hotline 1-800-THE-LOST was also established. And I had to add this in because if anyone else had a Teddy Ruxpin in the 80s, so Teddy Ruxpin became the official spokesbear. And Teddy had a series, an animated series that would air that featured a clip titled Protect Yourself. And in this episode, they would give safety information to the kids and they would be given the information by really famous actors at the time. Child actors. So it was like teaching stranger danger for the first time. The Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act was signed into law on July 27th, 2006. This was 25 years after Adam's abduction, and this created a national sex offender registry, and it required states to track sex offenders and share info across borders, and it increased penalties for crimes against children and improved tracking and background checks for foster and adoptive parents. Code ADAM was also invented, and this is a nationwide missing child safety protocol. It's used in retail stores, museums, malls, other public places across the United States, and it was created in memory of Adam Walsh. Code ADAM was activated inside a public space when a child is reported missing, and it's similar in concept to a lockdown or a fire drill, but it's for finding a lost or abducted child inside of a building. And Code ADAM was actually created by Walmart in 1994 and named after Adam Walsh. And this was a part of its child safety program. And then later, thousands of stores and buildings and federal facilities, they all adopted this same protocol. And the one I know you guys all know about. In 1987, the newly launched Fox television network was looking for bold, attention-grabbing programming. And they wanted to compete with major networks. So this producer, Michael Linder, had an idea. He wanted a weekly show featuring real fugitives and unsolved crimes with reenactments, call-in tips, and Fox greenlit the pilot. And they wanted to call the show America's Most Wanted. And the Fox producers, they knew they needed a host who was credible, relatable, and personally invested. And they wanted John Walsh. I mean, John Walsh was already known to the public as a grieving father turned advocate. He was media savvy. He was passionate. He is the voice of moral authority. He had no acting or TV background, but he had authenticity. So at first, John Walsh said, no, I don't want to do this. He said, I didn't want to be on TV. I wasn't a cop. I wasn't an actor. I was just a father trying to fight for kids like Adam. And the producers insisted, saying that if you do this, John, do you know how many lives you're going to save? How many lives you're going to change? Your personal story is going to inspire people to help call in. And I got to say, I was very lucky, very fortunate to see John Walsh speak at CrimeCon 2024. He was amazing. The feeling, the way he talks, the story, the way he tells it, I know this is such a line, but there wasn't a dry eye in that room. Crying, thinking about it. That man and everything that he and Reveille went through, it's just jaw-dropping that they were able to take something so horrific and create all of the things that they created in honor of their child. They're just so inspiring. America's Most Wanted premiered February 7th, 1988, and within 4 days, thanks to the viewers' tips, the first fugitive was caught. And over the next 25 plus years, America's Most Wanted helped capture over 1,200 fugitives, rescuing missing children and reuniting families. And John Walsh has become one of the most recognizable figures in American law enforcement media. John Walsh called himself a reluctant participant, but he was one who never wasted the platform that he was given. I just got so emotional just recording the last part of that episode, and it's also in part, it's due to you, just to the fact that I made it 100 episodes with the support of all of you, and I couldn't thank you enough. Thank you so much. I just need you guys to stay safe and stay paranoid.